There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. In this hour, we're going to hear about the latest UAE firm to sponsor an English football team, the former champions Leicester City. Plus, facilities management company Emeril has cancelled contracts with 40 suppliers, 40, because they didn't meet human rights standards. We're going to find out more. But first, it's deadline day for UAE companies to report their half-year profits or losses. Veteran investor Mohammed Yassin has spoken to us about Emaar, Etisalat and everything in between.
First of all, let's take the bigger picture view. If you look back on all the companies that have reported, and we've heard from the biggies like the Emaars and the Etisalats of this world, how's it been? Good, bad or indifferent?
I think neutral is the general trend we've seen. Most of those big companies, they came, we would say, within expectations, plus or minus 2 to 3% mostly. It's not really surprising in view of what we're seeing in terms of the economic cycle that we are in. On the banking sector, as you expect, the lending still continues to be, in single digits mostly, with the exception probably of DIB and Emirates NBD. And the real estate sector, of course, we've seen the Emaar and Dar. Emaar overall as a global company has done well, but the Emaar development part of it, which is the UAE concentrated part, came way below and affected their results for the sector.
Well, let's talk about real estate for a second, because I think this is interesting. About this time yesterday, we had the numbers from Damac, big developer. Mm-hmm. Their profits were down sharply, down by about 80-odd% or so. They made 800 million dirhams in the first half of last year, but just 80 million dirhams in the first half of this year. Emaar Development as well, you say, has seen a slowdown. Yet we spoke to Greg Fewer, the chief finance officer of Aldar, just a few days ago when their numbers came out, and they were really, really good. Sales have increased at Aldar in the first half of this year, and their profits have nudged higher as well. So I would have thought, essentially, real estate market in the UAE is a bit gloomy at the moment, therefore developers will all do badly. But there's been some inconsistencies, Mohammed, and I don't quite get that. What can you tell us?
Well, let me, if you allow me, I wouldn't put Damac in the same place with Emaar and Dar. Damac is a single developer, in my view. It's very concentrated, and it benefited from the boom of Dubai. But since 2014, it's just been going downhill, and I think it's been losing market share. Because mostly they don't have the financial power like Dar and Emaar, where they can, for example, give you 5 years post handover payment plans where they are subsidizing that financing of it. Dar and Emaar are two strong stories. Emaar is the global one out of all these three companies, in my view. But still, UAE looked in terms of deliveries of units. So you do sell, for example, the first lot, when you launch the project, you sell the 5-10%. But when it comes to the delivery of the last, maybe 60% of the project, you find people are hesitant on paying, coughing up with that money to take those units up. And therefore, the company cannot realize those profits on its balance sheet. Dar has benefited because it sold some land. If you remember, there was land in areas like Shahama and that area. And those kind of selling of land is usually high margin for those companies because they don't have to do development. Development is by the buyers. And therefore, they have a good mix of, if you want, kind of in their portfolios of land, units, villas, and therefore they can mix and try to avoid kind of slowness in certain sectors. Still, the growth that we expect, the reflection of where we are today, I think Emaar and Dar are managing much better than them for now.
Finally, a quick word on takeovers, mergers and acquisitions. We've seen a few recently. We've got the big one in Abu Dhabi that's going on. I know you're looking at Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank, UNB and Al Hilal. We've got Shuar Capital being taken over, investment bank here. Here in Dubai, you've got a DIB and Norbank. Quite a few, particularly in the finance sector. What impact will that have going forward on the UAE's banking scene?
Well, I think, honestly, the ADCB, UMB and Hilal is really a mega kind of merger within the UAE sector. We were hoping that the kind of results would be much more positive, but the ADCB results in Q2 of the combined banks units was disappointing to the market. It looks like there's some cleanup operations still going on between the some of the balance sheets of the other banks. On the Dubai, I think the Noor and Dubai Islamic, it's a smaller kind of merger because Noor Bank is like about 22% of assets of Dubai DIB. It looks like it's good. Noor Bank is being taken at a time where it is really clean with good growth of 20+, so it should help DIB with their results going forward. And Emirates NBD, I think they decided to go with their Turkish kind of takeover, and that looks like a if it works really and it delivers the numbers that we talked about, Emirates NBD will become the global bank of the UAE, I think, because they have a franchise in other than the UAE. They have Saudi, they have Egypt, and you take this European bank with 14 countries presence, and then you really have a global bank based here starting from the UAE. But honestly, I refer to the point that you also just talked about of the inverted yield curve also and the effects on the banking sector. And that worries us a bit because that could have some negative effects on going forward on the bank's willingness to lend. Because they really is the lending at the longer term doesn't give the kind of returns as on the shorter terms, and banks may not be willing to lend long term with such environment. So let's wait and see how this affects Q3 also going forward.
Mohammed, great talking to you as ever. Thanks very much indeed. Chief Strategy Officer at Al Dhabi Capital, Mohammed Yassin, appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You are listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. I'm really interested and excited about this next interview because we're going to speak to a company that has set standards and is sticking to them. Facilities management company Emeril has cancelled contracts with 40 of its suppliers because they say they didn't meet human rights standards. We are joined now in the studio by Susie Razumdjou, who is the commercial director at Emeril. Susie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
What's going on?
Well, Emeril has always been about its people. We've always had a high focus on welfare. And what we decided to do was expand this focus into our supply chain. And the reason that we did this was we felt that we had a responsibility to ensure that every employee that we work with was well taken care of and was living in accommodation standards that were fit for purpose. So what we decided to do was take 100 of our senior managers from across the business, empower them to personally go and visit supplier accommodations and inspect them against some predefined criteria. And to date, we have inspected more than 250 locations.
Did the companies know you were coming? Were they sort of surprise visits?
No, they knew that we were coming. We had contacted them in advance. They weren't aware of the standards that we were going to be inspecting against, but we did pre-warn.
So tell me about those standards. I mean, what standards have you set? Are there general guidelines? Are they sort of globally recognised guidelines?
So our standards were based fully aligned to the Dubai Municipality minimum standards. So we ensured that we had those as the baseline. We did encourage enhancements where possible. So for example, more washroom facilities, better recreational facilities, more common areas, etc.
And 40 of those companies didn't meet the minimum standards.
The results were mixed and they were shocking. 10% of the locations that we have inspected to date failed to meet the minimum criteria. A significant portion of those actually failed to the extent where they were deemed unfit for human habitation. So just to give you some context on what that means. So that means significantly low levels of cleanliness, unfit bedroom facilities. Overcrowding was a huge issue. We had significant pest control infestations. So for example, bed bugs, cockroaches, rats. We had non-functional safety equipment, taped up smoke alarms, rusted sprinkler systems, hose pipes that were not connected to anything. So significant failures and significant breaches.
Have you reported, if these companies obviously aren't meeting the Dubai Municipality standards, have you reported them for not doing so?
So if you have breaches that do not meet municipality standards, it is the right thing to do to report these companies. What we were able to do very successfully was actually work closely with these suppliers to ensure that the standards where they were non-compliant were actually raised to meet the minimum standards. And we are really proud of those successes.
But you've still cancelled contracts with a load of companies. So presumably 40 companies, couldn't be bothered raising their standards?
Well, there were a number of reasons why we cancelled contracts. And it is important to note that we didn't set out to cancel contracts. We weren't here to punish suppliers or terminate relationships. Our goal was to improve living standards. Some suppliers refused to participate completely in our initiative. They wouldn't even allow us access. Some suppliers did fail to meet the minimum standards and did not show willingness to improve.
That's absolutely shocking.
It is. It is shocking. And I think as a human walking in to some of those accommodations and being present in standards such as that is very, very uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. And it was shocking. And I think what was even more shocking is some of the management in those companies had never actually visited their own accommodation. And when they actually walked in and saw the standards that they were putting in place for their employees, that was a real eye-opener. And actually, they started to drive those improvements themselves.
Those that didn't improve, though, I mean, what did they say to you about why they weren't going to pull their socks up?
A lot of companies were very nervous about cost impact. And I think cost impact is something that you have to have your eyes open to. It is a risk that you have to face. However, it is worth noting that there are accommodations out there in the market that are compliant, that do not cost more than the accommodations that are non-compliant.
But so they'd rather lose a contract with you guys, a giant of the industry, than do the right thing by their workers and shell out a little bit and eat into their profit margin.
Unfortunately so. I think the majority of the contracts that we cancelled did fall into the category of not willing to allow access whatsoever. The majority of companies that we inspected that failed, we are proud to say we worked closely with them to improve the standards to the level required. And that was a huge success. In fact, some companies actually voluntarily relocated completely. And we were able to walk into brand new accommodation and see that there were, in some cases, hundreds of employees that were now living in significantly better standards than they were previously. And that was fantastic for us. We were really proud of that.
So is it now a standard part of your terms and conditions that if you're going to be a supplier to Emerald, you have to allow inspections by Emerald and its affiliates to look at the accommodation of your workers?
Yeah, so this is not a one-off initiative for us. This has now been embedded into our business processes. And we absolutely ensure that every new supplier that we engage with does have a visit to ensure that they are compliant and they do have to allow us access.
Does that have a cost implication for you? Because potentially when you're getting competitive bids in, as a company like you will do if you're getting someone to supply anything, goods or services, does that mean you're going to have to pay a little bit more for some services because the cheap suppliers may be the ones who won't allow you access?
In most cases, in the example that we have done, we have not had any cost impact. For the reason that there are multiple suppliers in the market, there doesn't have to be a cost impact for people complying with the minimum standards. And it is worthwhile noting that we're not asking people to comply with anything over and above what they're legally obligated to comply with anyway. So there doesn't have to be a cost impact if you approach this in the right way. I think collaboration and education is key here. You have to work with your partners to educate them why this is so important to do.
You're also teaming up with the CIPS, the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply, across the Middle East and North Africa, so that this isn't just an Emerald thing. Other organisations are looking at their supply chains and their suppliers. What kind of steps is that organisation going to take, and how can that make this more than just a... I mean, Emerald's a big company, but relatively speaking, it's a drop in the ocean in terms of the UAE or the wider region.
Absolutely. We as Emerald, as one company, can only do so much. We can only drive change to a certain extent within our supply chain. Companies like SIPS and other companies in the region that we are seeing are increasing their focus on worker welfare is essential. I think only when we work collectively and work together can we actually make a change and drive positive improvements in the region.
What does this say, bigger picture? What does this actually say about your industry and the standards within it? If you, one company, have uncovered so much and mistreatment of workers, because it is, if you're not providing them with the basics of sanitation and habitat, what's going on in the bigger industry?
I don't think this is limited to just our industry. I think we've all seen cases in the media where global companies have been exposed for providing substandard accommodation. This isn't limited to one industry or one country. This is an issue worldwide. And our region is fairly unique in some instances. We do have a large number of company-provided accommodation. We have a large number of expats, people away from their homes. their families, high temperatures. So worker welfare is critical in this region, but we're definitely not alone in facing these challenges.
And like you say, it is there's a bigger regional issue here. What do you think needs to happen? Obviously, Dubai Municipality has its standards in place, and we know that there has been huge drives from authorities recently to enforce and indeed improve those standards. Do you prefer a carrot or a stick approach?
I think a combination. I think what Dubai Municipality is doing is fantastic, and the standards in place are absolutely fit for purpose. I think what we need to do as an industry and as a region is work together, because we have a collective responsibility to ensure that the people that we employ and the people that we work with are taken care of.
And what has it meant for you in terms of contracts? Because if you have let 40 suppliers go, presumably you've had to find 40 new suppliers, draw up new contracts, put new systems in place. I mean, that sounds like you have created, I was about to say, additional work for yourself, and that's not actually what I mean. But do you know what I mean? Like Emeril has had to go the extra mile on this.
Yes, absolutely. And as a business, we committed to the fact that this would require an investment of time and effort. And we were more than happy to invest that into this project. And what we needed to do was ensure that we would not compromise on worker welfare. And that was the bottom line. And our goal was to improve standards and drive positive change in the region. And if that meant going out to market and finding alternative suppliers, then so be it.
We've had a number of SMSs in on this. Ian, for example, writes in saying, well done, Emeril, congratulating you on this initiative. Someone else writes in, though, saying one of the problems is that big companies like yourselves and others are driving down prices for competitive tenders so much, driving such a hard bargain that suppliers are forced to cut corners. I'm not saying I necessarily buy that argument, but it's a valid point.
I can understand that perspective, and the industry is tough at the moment, so I can understand the concern. However, it goes back to the fact that welfare standards are not optional. It's a requirement. You have to ensure that you are taking care of your people. That cannot be compromised on. So look into your business, find other ways to innovate, to improve productivity, to improve processes, so that your overall cost portfolio is not impacted.
Susie Razumdhoo, Commercial Director at Emeril, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. We want to know what you've got in your suitcase. What have you brought back from summer vacay that is a little bit cheaper to buy at home or abroad, or maybe just not available here in the UAE? Like Vogel's excellent toast bread, if you are listening, Spinnies. Last time I came back from New Zealand, I brought 6 loaves of Vogel's in my suitcase. It's currently in my freezer. I'm about to run out. It really should be stocked here. It's the best toast in the world.
There we go. Hashtag first world problem.
There is hats off for the imagination and the ingenuity of our listeners. A wide and varied array of things people have brought, from beauty stuff, face creams, etc., to foodstuffs, to cooking equipment, and a number of people who are bringing in car parts. This is Dina.
I brought back clay bars, and these were a lot cheaper over there, and the selection was a lot more. Just to refresh the paintwork, so that it helps in revitalizing the gloss of the car. Those were some things which I like to get, and some other accessories for the car. It's around 35-40% cheaper.
He's not alone. Steve has also been bringing in bits and pieces for his vintage car.
I have rather a special car, and I brought back a new aluminium radiator for it. Saved me a fortune.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I just love it. I've got 40 kilograms. I've got 37 kilograms. How can I make it work for me? Connie has done exactly what I've done, bringing in skincare from Australia. The exact same brand as I just came back with 6 bottles.
I bought a ton of products from The Ordinary brand. Most of it was the buffet, which is really good for the skin. And it was really, really cheap as compared to buying it online and paying the shipping cost. So I shipped it myself.
I've done the exact same thing, Connie. Alex reckons that his friends raised some eyebrows at what he brought back in his suitcase.
I brought very heavy cast iron skillets from Canada because I couldn't find the same one over here, and I found a very cheap one over there on the sale, and I got one, and it was half of the weight of my suitcase.
There you go, cast iron skillet. Man after my own heart, I have brought back a 16-piece copper saucepan set from the US. So I know of what you speak, Alex. The question is, Rich, I mean, people are telling us Lebanese za'atar, manuka honey from Australia, where it is wildly cheap. Wildly cheap. Do you see what I did there, manuka
Very
honey?
Very nice.
Should we be doing... We're not going to judge you on the legality of this.
Well, look, here's the thing. I'm looking at the list on the UAE Customs Authority of what you can and cannot bring into the country. There's a list of banned items. I think we all know what's banned. That's fine. There's a red line you cannot bring. There are certain things you cannot bring in. It's the grey area. And when it comes to food, there are some quite significant restrictions on what you can and cannot bring in. The Ministerial Resolution number 14 of 2016 clarified this pertaining to the control of imported food for non-commercial use. So, for example, what you can bring in... And actually, there's quite a lot you can bring in. For personal use, 20 kilograms of yogurt. I'm not sure how you would do that, but you can.
Well, you see, the suitcases, when they go in the hold, it's cold in the hold. Have you ever noticed that your suitcase comes out, it's a little bit frozen?
Yeah.
That's what I mean, I put stuff in there that should go in the fridge for that reason.
Fair enough. Yogurt's fine. 10 kilograms of fish and seafood. Grain, cereals and red meat is fine. Honey and sugar products are absolutely fine.
Hang on, red meat is fine.
No. Fish and seafood is fine. 11 kilograms of eggs, honey and sugar products are fine, herbs and spices are fine, so your za'atar from Lebanon is absolutely okay. There's no word on meat. Fish and seafood, 10 kgs is okay, but there's no word on meats in the list that I'm looking at. There is one specific reference, and this surprised me. And I'm reading verbatim from the UAE government customs website. Filipinos are warned against importing cooked duck eggs called balut without permission from the customs authorities. The person importing eggs should present a health certificate indicating the production and expiry date of the eggs and that the eggs have been produced in farms free from salmonella and bird flu. That gets a specific mention.
Do you know what? We have now moved from an interesting conversation to providing a public service, because in amongst all the messages from people saying that they have brought in haggis, potato scones, black pudding, certain cookies from the UK, a man called Tom Harvey has got in touch with us, and he has said this. Good morning, Richard and Brandy. I'm Tom Harvey. I'm the buying director at Spinney's, and I am just letting you know that I am listening very intently to what listeners are telling you this morning. Please share the list of all the products that they are telling you they bring in, and we will certainly look at what we can start to stock that we don't already sell. Tom, yes, message me your email and I will provide you that list. If we can get Vogel's toast bread out here to the UAE, it would change my life. It's brilliant.
Walker's French fries, Worcester sauce flavour.
Send us your email, Tom, and I will personally get back to you. A lot of people saying Lego as well, Rich.
Lego can be cheaper in other countries, although to be honest, Lego is never cheap. My wife has just come back from 3 days in Legoland with our eldest son. They've got quite a bit. It can be cheaper elsewhere, but it's never cheap.
Remarkable amount of people as well getting in touch with us with bikes. People who've brought back their own racing bikes. People who've brought a racing bike in a box, someone says. People who have brought back kids' bikes. I wouldn't have necessarily thought of a bike, but I admire the ingenuity.
Well, I bought a bike earlier on this year, and you can potentially buy them cheaper elsewhere. Once you get into things like bikes and cars, I kind of want... You're not just buying the piece of kit.
The warranty.
It's the warranty, and there's just the expertise. I bought it from a bike shop. Faisal's a great guy. If I've got a problem with him, I can call him up and say, no, this is how brakes work, you know, and simple things like that, which you don't get if you buy it from overseas. So for something relatively sophisticated like that, even if it is a bit more expensive, I'll pay a bit for the expertise.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai i 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
We're talking the business of sport now. Sudesh Girian is the chief executive of Express Money, and he joins us now on the line. You're with us today not to talk about money transfers, which is what we normally discuss, but to talk about sponsorship, because you have just signed a deal with the English football club Leicester City. You're going to be the official money remittance partner for Leicester City. Tell us a little bit about this deal and why you decided to do it.
It's been a fantastic tie-up, I should say, Richard, and we've been working on it for the last many months now, and somehow, Leicester City worked out very well for us. We identified many synergies between Express Money and Leicester City. We looked at the values both carry, like loyalty, integrity, collaboration, agility, diversity, which is a very, very important value which we both share. For example, now Leicester City Football Club has many players who have diverse backgrounds and they have diverse fans. Similarly, Express Money has diverse customers. We operate across 170 countries. We have a very, very diverse customer base, right? So we have a tremendous amount of synergy between Leicester City Football Club and Express Money. And both these have always raised the bar when it mattered. And if you look at Leicester City Football Club came back in 2016 when nobody had given them a chance to win the English Premier Football Club trophy. They came from behind to win the league in 2016. And something similar has happened with Express Money. And over the last 20 years, from very, very humble beginning, we are today counted among the most renowned international money transfer organizations in the world.
Sudesh, you're of course part of Finabler, the big financial services company based out of Abu Dhabi, but recently listed on the London Stock Exchange earlier on this year. How significant was the fact that you're now listed on the London Stock Exchange with the fact that it's a British football club that you've decided to go with?
Basically, I think, let me put it like this. We always wanted to create visibility for our brand, and the English Premier League being very, very important one. Over the next 9 to 10 months, we'll have great amount of visibility across Europe, across Africa, across the Middle East market. And this is what we wanted all along, to have that enhanced visibility. So that made us go and partner with Leicester City Football Club.
What do you actually get for this? Because you're not the shirt sponsor for Leicester City. I'm sure you're not going to tell me how much you're paying for this, but it'll be a significant amount of money you're investing. What kind of visibility will you get, either within the ground for people visiting the stadium in Leicester or for people watching on television in some of the countries that you mentioned?
In every manner, if you're on the ground in King Power Stadium, whenever the matches are played, You'll see our logo. We were very, very proud to see our logo being displayed all across the boundary on the 11th when the first official match was played. It is seen on the TV, of course, by millions and billions of people. And also, we will also get the player endorsements, of Leicester City Football Club. So all these things are going to create a great amount of visibility for many other fans.
One of the things that I noticed is that Leicester, a city in the United Kingdom, in England, it has the second biggest Indian-born population in the United Kingdom. London is first, and Leicester is second, with 37,000 people who are deemed to be of Indian origin in one way or another. Was that significant in any way?
That wasn't really so, because I just mentioned to you, we operate across 170 countries. We cater to many diasporas, and we operate across thousands of corridors in the world. So it is not just one community that we cater to. We cater to multiple communities, multiple diasporas. So it was basically with an aim to cater to multiple diasporas that we chose Leicester City Football Club.
Sudesh, finally, can't let you go without asking a question that Brandy Scott asked me earlier on this morning. We were chatting about the fact that we were going to be talking to you later on, and we were also looking at some new fintech developments in the field of money transfers and remittances. I'm going to bring Brandy in here because I'll let her ask the question that she asked me earlier. I didn't have an answer for her, Sudesh. I said, well, let's ask Sudesh a little bit later on. So I'll hand you over to Brandy.
I was curious, Sudesh, as to the future of your industry. To put it bluntly, with the majority of us banking online and so many options for the unbanked in terms of mobile phone transfers, Does remittances have a future?
Definitely they do. Remittances have a future. If you look at the size of the money transfer business, many people do not know this. Last year, the volume of money transfers sent and received globally was $689 billion. And it has been growing year after year. Just look at where the money transfers were in 2007. It was just about $400 billion, and it's almost touching $200 billion. There is a future for money transfer. But with all the banks jumping in, fintech jumping in, it's a great opportunity for us. I'm sure you know this. We have partnered with many banks, the likes of Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank, RAC Bank, lately Commercial Bank of Dubai, where all these banks use our platform for global remittance. And similarly, on the fintech side, we have partnered with the likes of World Remit, right, where World Remit uses our payout network across the globe. So we have been partnering with banks on one side and fintech on the other side. So it's been a great collaboration for us, and we have always seen such things as an opportunity for Express Money to grow.
Sudesh, thanks very much indeed for answering that question, obviously far more eloquently and insightfully than I could possibly have attempted. Sudesh Girian is the CEO of Express Money. Always nice talking to you. Appreciate you joining us on the line.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back Sunday morning, bright and early, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.